I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. There are just 7 weeks left until Election Day, and voting is already underway in many battleground states. President Trump is campaigning in Arizona today on a trip to the West that is also giving him his first view of the devastating wildfires in California. He held a packed indoor rally in Nevada last night in defiance of the state's social distancing rules. Meanwhile, Joe Biden's getting a boost from a former rival. Former New York mayor and billionaire Michael Bloomberg pledged to pump $100 million into Florida to help Biden there. Let's bring in NPR national political correspondent Mara Liasson. Hi, Mara.
Hi, Jeremy.
Well, let's start with that rally yesterday. Nevada's governor slammed President Trump for holding that indoor rally, called it shameful, dangerous, and irresponsible. But the Trump campaign insists they took proper precautions. Here's what campaign senior advisor Jason Miller said on ABC's This Week.
We take safety very seriously, George. That's why people are given masks when they come in if they don't already have them. We do temperature checks. We have plenty of hand sanitizer. We encourage people very strongly to wear the masks. And this is something that President Trump takes very seriously. And we're good to see a lot of folks there taking our direction here.
Still, it appears many people at the rally did not wear the masks that were provided. Why is the president taking this risk by having an indoor rally when all the experts say that's a bad idea?
Well, you know, how you feel about the pandemic is now the front line of the culture war. Do you think it was once a hoax, then it was real, now it's over, which is kind of Trump's view? Or do you think that you should be socially distancing and following the administration's own guidelines about large gatherings? The president decided to take this risk. One message for the Sunday shows, they take it very seriously. One message for his rally, where the only people wearing masks were the people right behind him on the stage. Mm-hmm. Now, either that was to protect Trump, or it was to avoid getting a fine by local officials, or maybe it was just for the cameras. But hardly anyone outside of the people right around Trump were wearing a mask.
Mm-hmm. On the Biden side of things, Michael Bloomberg announced he's committing $100 million of his own money into the race in Florida. What will that money do? And could it be crucial in determining who wins Florida?
Absolutely. It could be a game changer. Michael Bloomberg famously promised to spend whatever it takes to defeat Trump, no matter who was the nominee. He hasn't done that yet. But $100 million in Florida means a lot. It frees up Biden's money to be spent elsewhere, like in other battleground states. I think it's going to be helping Biden reach non-Cuban Hispanics, where he has lagged behind Hillary Clinton from 2016. And Florida is a state that Trump has to win if he's going to get to 270 electoral votes. Biden has a couple other routes without Florida to get to 270, but there's no doubt that the Bloomberg money could be a game changer in Florida because it's going to force Trump to spend more money there than he had otherwise planned to do.
Well, and speaking of money and the Trump campaign, they appear to be cutting back on some TV spending in some crucial states. We've heard about the fact that they're losing their financial advantage to Biden. How much trouble are they in when it comes to money and resources?
I don't think they're in as much trouble as some people are saying. There's no doubt that Biden has closed the money gap, but Donald Trump still has plenty of money to do what he needs to do. The problem is that Biden has been trying to expand the map and make Trump play defense in places like Florida or other states he won in 2016, like Arizona or North Carolina or Georgia. And it's interesting, a lot of Democrats, after Bloomberg dumped $100 million into Florida, are waiting to see if he'll dump $50, $30 million into North Carolina or Arizona or other states. And that would put a lot of financial pressure on Trump.
By the end of this week, five states will have started early voting, but the president is doubling down on his baseless claims that mail-in ballots are rife with fraud. Do we have any sense yet of how many people are going to be voting by mail on each side, Republicans and Democrats?
Well, we know that Democrats in huge numbers tell pollsters they're going to vote by mail. In some cases, it's 80 to 20. Republicans, much less. Maybe 50-50. Republicans listen to Donald Trump. Donald Trump says mail-in voting is bad and fraudulent. So Republicans who used to have an advantage in mail-in voting are now deciding not to vote by mail, and the president could be hurting himself. In other words, this could backfire. In a state like Florida, if Republicans decide not to vote by mail, and a lot of them are seniors, maybe they'll just stay home because they don't want to go to the polls during a pandemic. Now, the interesting thing about the Trump campaign messaging is they're trying to say, don't vote by mail, except in Florida, because Florida is an interesting state. It's among the battleground states. It's the only one that actually counts and reports its mail-in ballots on election night.
Right.
And many Democrats think Trump is planning to, if he's ahead on election night with the ballots counted just that day, to declare victory and say any other ballots that come in later are fraudulent.
That is NPR national political correspondent Mara Liasson.
At least 35 people have died in the fast-moving wildfires across California, Oregon, and Washington state. And the governors of all three states have been explicit about their belief in the link between climate change and the severity of this wildfire season, as temperatures get hotter and conditions drier. But President Trump, who is expected to visit Northern California today, blamed the massive wildfires on another problem.
It's about forest management. And other things, but forest management.
Let's bring in Ezra Romero. He's a reporter for Capital Public Radio in Sacramento. Hi, Ezra.
Hello.
Well, first of all, is President Trump correct in his criticism? How much does land and forest management factor into the magnitude of these wildfires that we're experiencing right now?
Well, forest management does play a huge role in all of this, but then there's a huge factor on top of all of that, climate change making the problem worse. You know, there's been a more than a century of fire suppression on the land, and that's dating back to like 1910. This big Great Fire burned 3 million acres of the West then. And then after that, the Forest Service created a policy to put fires out as quickly as possible. So that mentality spread across the states, and it resulted in very few big fires and so much overgrowth of dead and alive trees and brushing grass on land. Just to put this in a little bit of perspective, there's around 33 million acres of forest in California. About 57% of that, or 19 million acres, is managed and owned by the Forest Service and other federal entities. Only 3% is owned by the state. 40% is managed by families, Native Americans, and companies.
Oh, wow.
And 14% by timber. And so there's this 9 million acres owned by people, individuals, and they all have like 50 acres or less. So it's this very complex system, but over half is managed by the federal government.
Okay, so a complex system, but some climate scientists have argued that even though we're seeing climate change in real time, states like California underpredicted the intensity and speed of the spread. Can you explain the methods used to mitigate wildfires for that land that's really under the jurisdiction of the government?
Yeah, there's three ways they go about this. One is called a prescribed burn. That's where fires are lit on purpose in cooler months to burn excess debris on the land. Then there's something called mechanical thinning, where crews go out with chainsaws and giant masticators. Those are big machines that treat big trees like they're toothpicks and pile them up. And then there's something called managed burns, where natural burns happen on the land, whether it's from lightning or something else, and they're allowed to burn. And that happens in places like Yosemite National Park and sometimes on Forest Service land. And so all these three things combined are what scientists talk about what needs to happen, but it's not always happening that way.
Okay. Can you give us a sense of why it's not always happening this way?
Yeah, it's really expensive to do these kinds of burns, right? And then we had the drought where we had 129 million trees killed by bark beetles in the mid-2000s. And so we're still living with the ramifications of that. And so there were about 100,000 or 200,000 acres of these pine trees taken out around forests, campsites, even more where people live. But the problem and scale of the issue is so large and so big. And we're also just reacting to wildfires these days. You know, they're burning at such a high rate in such large sizes that we're in this mode of just putting them out and making sure they don't go to these towns and cities where people live. So there's this tension we're in of, we know we have to clean the forests in this way, but we're also in this tension of, we're not in a place where we're funded to do that.
You've been talking with quite a few experts about this. What have they been saying to you?
Well, I want to be clear here. They all say we need to do more in the off season exponentially. But climate scientists are clear that if we don't get the climate crisis under control, we are going to be in the cyclical cycle of having fire on the landscape at this size and scale. Yes, California is a Mediterranean climate. Fires have happened here for millennia. Some UC Berkeley scientists found that before the year 1800, there was about 4.5 million acres of land that burned here every year. So it's a natural phenomenon here. But scientists say that if we hit a magical button and all the land was clean and clear and all this underbrush and understory was nice and dandy, the climate crisis would still be there. And fires would still be happening at a higher rate than they were in the past.
So you really can't separate these two, climate change and really the caring for the land and the clearing of the land.
Exactly. And that's exacerbated today even by the fact that there's 40 million Californians, and that wasn't what it was 100 years ago. And there's about 3 million people who live in these forested areas. So it's a complex issue.
That was Ezra Romero. He's a reporter for Capital Public Radio in Sacramento.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from MIT System Design and Management, jointly offered by MIT School of Engineering and the MIT Sloan School of Management. Earn a master's in engineering and management. SDM educates mid-career professionals to solve complex challenges at the intersection of business and technology. With over 20 years of on-campus and distance education experience, join a virtual info session on Wednesday, September 16th from 9 to 10 a.m., sdm.mit.edu.
This is Here and Now. Museums throughout the country are slowly welcoming back visitors. But in the midst of this pandemic and the ongoing protests for racial justice, the world they are opening their doors to has changed significantly. And curators are now thinking deeply about how to reflect our new reality and the roles they play in society. To talk more about this, I have Portia Moore, professor of museum studies at the University of Florida and co-creator of Visitors of Color, and Tyree Boyd-Pates, an associate curator of Western history at the Autry Museum of the American West in L.A. Welcome.
Thank you for the opportunity.
So, Tyree, I want to start with you. You joined the Autry Museum here in L.A. at the end of last year, but you've been in this space for a while now to recenter Black histories in museum spaces. How have you as a curator in this moment been re-examining the role of the museum, and what have you been doing during this time to respond to the moment?
Museum curators, as well as museums themselves, are seeking to rise to the occasion. We all find ourselves in a historical moment. And at the Autry Museum, we are reimagining and wrinkling the interpretation of who, in fact, inhabits the American West. Currently, I am spearheading an initiative entitled Collecting Community History, the West during COVID-19, as well as BLM protests in the West, which is a archival historical project that seeks to aggregate and generate content from the communities that surround the museum so that we can better retell this moment for future generations.
Portia, the way Tyree is thinking is kind of a difference from what many museums have historically viewed what should be exhibited. I'm thinking about the 1960s New York Met exhibit, all about Harlem, that excluded Black artists. And the Met actually just recently came under fire with staff saying that it has a culture of systemic racism. Portia, what is the history and legacy of museums in this country? How do we get to the real purpose of museums to capture the art and history of right now?
The number of callouts that we've seen in the last several weeks in terms of naming and identifying systemic and institutional racism, I think speak to the fact that our institutions and those who work in our field have never really had to think about whiteness and to think about dismantling whiteness and to really unpack the power of racial literacy. And so when I think about the work that curators like Tyree are doing, when I think about the things that people are doing across the country, I think one of the things that we can do is to help us understand the ways in which our cultural heritage institutions can actually rise to this moment and rise to the occasion, and helping us to think about how we can actually really grow and evolve and transform to 21st century cultural heritage information centers. So there's actually no museum in America right now, sort of regardless of their mission and their vision and their collecting practices, that is unable to kind of help promote necessary 21st century literacies. So some of those literacies would include historical literacy, civic literacy, visual literacy, and then most critically and specifically, racial literacies. So I believe that it's our job to kind of help promote a pedagogy of critical inquiry. And I think that as we move forward, it will be possible for our museums to really think about this notion of the canon, troubling what Toni Morrison calls the master narrative, and allowing us to get back to the place where we can sort of decenter whiteness.
You're also working on making museums accessible and welcoming spaces. You've created a space called Visitors of Color, which pushes museums to think of visitors as active participants and not just donors or patrons of the arts. Can you say more about that?
So that Visitors of Color project is a counter-narrative project. It's our sort of offering to help museum professionals especially understand the ways in which we have to problematize this notion of welcoming and belonging, the ways in which we unintentionally other our visitors, and helping us to understand the ways in which we think about everything from our behaviors, our collective behaviors, so the ways in which we sort of police Black bodies in white spaces, the ways in which we do or do not promote joy, the ways in which we tell narratives that actually can be traumatizing or triggering.
Tyree, how much are you thinking about what Portia is saying when you're thinking about who might be coming to the museum when you curate exhibits?
Thinking of communities of color, particularly the Black community, at the top of mind, I always want to make sure that their stories are centered on the gallery walls, that they feel dignified and elevated when they see representations of themselves on those walls, as well as an opportunity to further investigate what their history has always been, irrespective of who has chosen to center it.
That's really interesting. Do you have an example of an exhibit that you've done or maybe others have done that really yeah. illustrate what you're talking about?
Oh, absolutely. I have several. Most recently, I curated alongside a fantastic team at the California African American Museum, an exhibit entitled Cross Colors, Black Fashion in the 20th Century, where we reclaimed...
We featured that here on Here and Now.
Oh,
yeah.
Oh, you did. Oh, shout out to that. Woo, woo, woo. where we in that exhibition that I co-curated alongside Taylor Bythewood Porter was an exhibition that reclaimed the narrative of Black fashion in America, but in fact, focusing on the ways in which a hip-hop apparel brand based out of Los Angeles, Cross Colors, actually was able to contribute to a $1 billion fashion industry. But what the exhibition did specifically is, beyond just showing textiles across the 5,000 square foot space, it actually reclaimed the ways in which Cross Colors and their design choices actually paralleled larger social movements across over the course of 100 years, from Marcus Garvey all the way to Bruno Mars. And so these kind of reclamation pieces, and also having mannequins with Black skin throughout the entire space, recenters the African-American community in a very engaging way that doesn't only center them, but also gives them the privilege that society tends to steal from them oftentimes in other spaces.
We've listened to all of the ways you all see how museums can be prepared to really accurately portray this moment in the future of people in this country. But the pandemic has really changed the way we all interact with public physical spaces like museums. Is their role solely attached to being able to visit them, or does this work expand beyond that? I'll start with you, Tyree.
This work absolutely expands beyond the brick and mortar. I believe, in fact, with the brick and mortar closing, for the most part, institutions, again, have to rise to the occasion to not only engage with the stakeholders they've always had, but the future stakeholders that they've always desired. And I think with this larger reckoning that we're having racially in this country, these institutions are understanding how their complicity in larger institutional discrimination and oppression And it behooves them to, again, incorporate museological approaches like community curation, where they, in fact, partner with the community in larger museum decision-making processes. So these communities, in fact, can feel reflected not only through exhibitions, but public programming and other endeavors. And I believe that this moment digitally allows these institutions to meet people where they are with the content that their holdings have always expressed.
Portia.
I tend to look at examples by museums such as the Smithsonian Asian Pacific American Museum that created what they are calling culture labs. And they have something called a culture lab manifesto, which is essentially going back to Tyree's point about this, the power of co-creation. So they have this sort of mantra, nothing about us without us. And I feel like in this particular moment, museums have a vast opportunity to now directly engage with all of these different community members that they've previously been unable to reach. We can really examine the ways in which we can use social media platforms in a way to not only create dialogic spaces, but also kind of create digital events and happenings. I mean, look at all of the different DJs that were able to kind of basically help everyone heal in real time, right? We can kind of apply that same methodology to the ways in which our museums and their social media platforms can kind of go beyond the walls and kind of create not only a sense of community, but again, a sense of belonging, a sense of healing. It's a place where we can explore different ideas. We can sort of open up the vaults. We can go behind the scenes, pull out different objects, curate conversations. We can even if visitors aren't necessarily allowed into the physical space, we can still allow the museum as an actual institution to then reframe its actual function and purpose. So I'm thinking specifically about, I believe it was the Brooklyn Museum that allowed its site to be a food distribution center, right? Mm-hmm. So we can think about the ways that the museum is not just a sort of a physical space, but that it actually can go beyond that. So this notion of like museum without borders.
That's Dr. Portia Moore, professor of museum studies at the University of Florida and co-creator of Visions of Color, and Tyree Boyd Pates, historian and associate curator of Western history at the Autry Museum of the American West in LA. Thank you all both for this conversation.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Negotiations are underway to end decades of war in Afghanistan. The historic talks between the Taliban and delegates appointed by the Afghan government opened in Doha, Qatar on Saturday. The BBC's Sikander Kermani joins us via Skype. And Sikander, first of all, describe the significance of the Taliban and the Afghan government sitting in the same room together.
This is a huge deal. I mean, this is the first formal direct talks since this conflict began nearly 20 years ago. And many of these people who are sitting in the same room as each other have lost family members in the conflict. They've been targeted in attacks themselves. So it's a huge thing for them just to be sitting in the same room and talking to each other. And it's certainly engendering a real sense of cautious hope amongst Afghans that one day peace could be reached.
Let's talk a little bit about the challenges, though. So Saturday was for ceremony, but the real negotiations will be held behind closed doors. And there are several serious issues: a ceasefire, the rights of women and minorities, disarming Taliban fighters. Isn't it going to be really difficult to reach a consensus on all of this or any of this?
It's going to be a huge challenge. I mean, if we take the ceasefire first of all, I mean, that's, of course, what most ordinary Afghans are really looking for out of this process: a ceasefire, an end to the violence, even if it's temporary, even if it's only in parts of the country, perhaps, would be what would make the most difference to their to their lives. Let's not forget that thousands of ordinary Afghans are killed every year as a result of this conflict. It's by many measures the deadliest war going on in today's world. And Afghan officials are particularly keen on a ceasefire being reached. For them, that's the priority in these negotiations. But for the Taliban, well, they've really always been reluctant to accept a ceasefire. And that's really because they see the violence as their best form of leverage, their best means of achieving this new Islamic form of government that they want to create. And they're not exactly clear, really, what that form of government is. But I think most analysts agree that until they feel their demands are being met, they're not going to put their weapons down. They're also concerned that their fighters, if they stop fighting, will be hard to remobilize once again, could even drift away to other rival militant groups like the Islamic State group, for example. So that then really brings us to the next big challenge, which you touch upon, which is the competing visions for the future of the country that these two sides mm-hmm. have.
I want to go back a little bit to what you were talking about regarding the Taliban strategy. I mean, they carried out attacks in the days before these talks even started. Do the people of Afghanistan have any faith they'll see peace in their lifetimes?
Well, you've got to remember, in Afghanistan, the country's been more or less in a state of conflict ever since 1979, when the USSR, the Soviet Union, invaded Afghanistan. So people are certainly cautious and people are certainly skeptical, but there is hope, because these are the first time that we've seen at least this level of progress within the peace process. Will it come to fruition? It's really, really hard to predict, but at least there's an opportunity right now, and that at least is giving people hope.
That's the BBC's Sikandar Karmani in Islamabad. Sikandar, thank you so much.
Thank you.
If you exclude the military and postal workers, the federal workforce includes more than 2 million people. These are people working at agencies like the Department of Energy, Education, Agriculture, Housing and Urban Development, and on and on. The size and scope of the federal government in 2020 has come under attack from some who hope to prove in the courts that this bureaucracy is not what the founders intended.
The American people know best how to run their own lives. They don't need Washington bureaucrats controlling their every move and micromanaging their every decision.
And what the president was specifically addressing is a real frustration with some of the bureaucrats to think that they can just do this the way they normally do it.
Corrupt, high-ranking, deep state bureaucrats set him up.
Cabal of diplomatic and intel bureaucrats.
To unelected, unaccountable bureaucrats placed within the executive branch of government.
Well, two Harvard law professors have a book out this week defending what they call the administrative state. They are Cass Sunstein and Adrian Vermeule, and their book is called Law and Leviathan, Redeeming the Administrative State. Welcome to both of you. And first off, Adrian, define the administrative state. You're just talking about all the federal agencies?
Yes, absolutely. The federal government has, I think, about 2 million non-defense civilian employees. It has a massive infrastructure, institutional, and personnel. And that is the administrative state in brief, and that's the thing that is being challenged in this movement.
Well, and the movement, Cass Sunstein, is mostly coming from the right, correct?
Mostly, though not only. So when people hear the words the deep state, they're unlikely to smile or jump for joy. The basic idea, and it does cut across political differences, is that we have this big administrative apparatus, and it's, you know, it might be the Environmental Protection Agency or the Department of Agriculture or the Department of Health and Human Services, and they're nameless, faithless bureaucrats, and they are, on the view of the skeptics, they are deeply inconsistent with liberty and democracy.
And you do not believe that that is the case?
We don't. We think that these people, and there are a lot of them, work ultimately under laws enacted by Congress and work for the President of the United States, whether he's a Democrat or Republican, and that they do essential things, whether it's protecting safety on the roads or protecting us against the risk of a pandemic, maybe imperfectly, very much imperfectly in both cases. But we need a state, we need administrators, and this does go back to the founding, to protect our essential rights, including our right to property and our right to liberty. So we don't think that the administrative state is inconsistent with the Constitution or with democracy, and we don't think that, at least if it's properly constrained, it's a threat to liberty either. In fact, we need people who are protecting road safety, who are protecting air quality, who are protecting property rights, who are protecting liberty in multiple ways, including liberty from private and public violence. We need that.
Cass Sunstein, isn't one of the reasons why this is such a debate that the Constitution is not entirely clear on this sort of thing, because these agencies didn't exist, certainly not in the size and scope that they are now, when the founders wrote the Constitution?
Okay, so let's distinguish between two views. One is that the administrative apparatus is a 20th century horror in which the constitutional commitments to self-government have been systematically violated. That's a view. It's prominent. There's another view, which is that this isn't actually anything really new. We had departments and agencies back at the founding period, and the framers knew that was going to happen and participated in their creation. So the size and scope is different now. It's larger. It's a very different country. But there's a lot of continuity with things that go back to Madison and Hamilton and Washington and even Jefferson. Still, the risks of a large administrative apparatus are real. It requires transparency. It means that the rules can't contradict each other. And very fundamentally, the rules that are announced in Washington have to be consistent with the rules that are administered from Washington. That's when things are working well. When they aren't working so well, we need to use these specific understandings of the rule of law to ensure that it's realized in the world in which we live.
Often this issue makes it all the way to the Supreme Court, and you write in this book that according to Neil Gorsuch's philosophy, key provisions of the Clean Air Act, the Occupational Safety and Health Act, the National Traffic and Motor Vehicle Safety Act might well be struck down. Adrian Vermeule, what are the cases that you're watching for, and what's at stake here for our listeners as they think about how this applies to them?
Yes, this is terribly important. So a bit of context. In the past 5 years or so, there's been enormous excitement among the legal circles who want to fundamentally challenge the administrative state. And the excitement has been over the prospect of getting the Supreme Court to revive certain doctrines that they see as limiting the administrative state. So one is called the non-delegation doctrine that would say agencies can't be given broad power to regulate in the public interest. I think what's been striking is how little headway that legal movement has made. So we haven't seen this kind of dramatic retrenchment of the administrative state that a number of these litigation groups and proponents have hoped for. What is true is that the court has done what we recommend in the book, which is instead of limiting the substantive scope and power of the administrative state, it's asked the administration, have you thought about this enough? Have you taken into account the harms your change in regulation are inflicting? And these kinds of procedural and requests for deliberation and thorough consideration of administrative action are exactly the sorts of things we recommend. And that's the direction the court has gone.
Why did you want to write this book, Cass Sunstein?
Well, we had, I think, two goals in mind. One is to say the basic assault on the administrative state, which we're seeing in many countries, certainly in the United States, is wrongheaded and it threatens to undermine, not to improve, our system of self-government. The second is to trace and sketch a set of ideas, really simple and intuitive, as well as time-honored, that can be used to help protect against the excesses and mistakes and worse of the administrative state all over the world, and put a big spotlight on a value that isn't the same as free markets. It's not the same as equality. It's not the same as liberty, even. It is the same as the rule of law. And if we introduce that into our administrative apparatus, as to a large extent we have when the system's working well, then we will be able to redeem a project that unifies some very different people in American history, including Alexander Hamilton, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, and Ronald Reagan.
Let me finally ask you, Adrian Vermeule, why come out with this book 2 months before the presidential election?
We don't mean the book to have a direct tie-in to current politics, because the principles that we're talking about are developed over time, really since the foundation of our law, and certainly since the enactment of the Administrative Procedure Act in 1946. So we hope it's a bit more enduring than that. That said, I think it does have direct relevance to current politics and what the Supreme Court has been doing recently, because, as I said, the court has been faced with a choice between two different paths. One is fundamentally antagonistic and trying to limit the administrative state, and the other path is an attempt to make it the best it can be through bringing it to its best self through these procedural channeling and disciplining mechanisms. And that's the path that we see it taking, and that's where we see the future going.
That is Adrian Vermeule. We've also been speaking with Cass Sunstein, both Harvard professors. Their new book is called Law and Leviathan. Thank you so much to both of you.
Thank you.
And as always, we've got an excerpt from the book at hereandnow.org.
There's almost no community on the West Coast untouched by the massive fires burning in California, Oregon, and Washington state. Dozens of people have died, thousands have had to flee, and unsafe air makes it impossible to spend any significant amount of time outdoors. Today, we hear from the people most impacted about how they're grappling with the fires and the smoke.
This is Natalie from Richmond, California. I can't really describe how disturbing it has been. I'm a physical therapist, and I can see the ways in which this is affecting my patients and their mental health. They're talking about lack of motivation, about worsened pain, and it really makes me worry about whether or not there's actually anything that we can do at this point to make it better.
Hi, my name is Colby Jackson. I live in Redding, California. The last few days, I've been working hauling fire supplies to the fire camps in Northern California. Over in Ruth and Chico, Orville, Orleans, and it's just heartbreaking to see all the destruction that is going on from the fires. It reminds me of our own community in 2018 when the Carr Fire came through. I think after this, we need to do something with our forests besides nothing. They need to be harvested. And I'm not saying that because logging is my normal occupation. I'm saying that because it needs to be done. If you see the forest, you can look at it and see it. It's a dying ecosystem.
Hi there, this is Amber, and I am in Portland. I'm standing outside and I'm looking up right now. The sky is dramatically gray. There's tons of smoke, unbelievable amount of smoke. I wish that the federal government and the state government and local governments, in partnership with indigenous peoples of the areas, would get together and learn from indigenous peoples about how fire management has been done, you know, since time immemorial. I hope that our governments begin to take serious what Indigenous peoples have to offer in the conversation around climate change and living in partnership and in harmony with nature.
This is Intisara Bioto, and I'm in Portland, Oregon. And when I look out my window, what I'm seeing is a dense orange-tinted white fog. Orange on gray on orange, filtering through the blinds. The time of day merges too with no shadows and the sun of this kind of red pink glow. That fear, just this pain in my belly, really like I never felt. Fear of death, fear of being trapped, of loss of environment, fear for others. I packed some bags with my family. We did book a flight for my youngest sister who has respiratory challenges to go back down south with family. So we got her out of here early on Friday morning. I just feel for everyone who has lost their home. I feel for the people who have lost their loved ones. I mean, that's just a nightmare.
My name is Emily McCarty, and I live in Yakima, Washington. But right now, I am driving through Spokane, Washington, which is in the eastern part of the state. I woke up this morning, actually, in Olympic National Park, which is on the Olympic Peninsula on the west side of the state. And just in those 24 hours, it was just blanketed in smoke. It was horrible going over the pass. We didn't know if the high elevation would change it, but it's just filled with smoke and it is horrible. My eyes are itchy and I tried turning the air in my car to, you know, inner circulate, and it was just horrible. Nothing helps.
This is Dave Crowther in Seattle, Washington. Looking up into the sky and looking down the street, you can just carve out the air. Everything is just with this veil of a 1970s industrial Eastern European blech in the air. It's pretty windless. You're hearing some birds. We've had smoke in the past. We've had this come from Eastern Washington where we've had fires and whatnot. Not this late in the year ever that I recall. It's just really odd.
This is Beto Yarse and I'm in Seattle, Washington. The smoke has been evolving and getting to a point that is very scary. I do feel very worried about the people that doesn't have a shelter, that they are homeless, that they are suffering. And I'm very sad to see the inequality again on how individuals with less resources always are the ones with more vulnerability. And also as an immigrant from Mexico who decided to move to the Pacific Northwest almost 20 years ago, because the beauty of this region, how green and clean and all what the Pacific Northwest offer. And definitely a wake-up call that we need to kind of really evaluate what we're doing as a humanity.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR and NPR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.